I'm Steve McLeod, and this is Bootstrapped, the podcast for people running bootstrapped software companies or wanting to run one. I run two bootstrapped software products, Feature Upvote, which lets your customers vote on ideas to improve your product, and Sabre Feedback, which offers a feedback widget you can add to your website. Follow along as I learn from talking to other bootstrappers and experts, and just maybe you'll learn something too. I'm joined today by Liz Painter, founder of Comma Comma, a copywriting agency based in Birmingham, UK. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, did I pronounce it right? Is it Birmingham or Birmingham?
Birmingham.
Birmingham.
Yeah, Birmingham. Okay. Yeah. All of our place names are all different. Like, there's no consistency.
I lived in London for a few months, and I think even in that few months, I didn't learn how to say place names correctly. It was like really strange. It looked like English, but it didn't sound like English.
A lot of Londoners don't even say Birmingham right, and I'm from London, so.
Good to know. I'm not alone. Hey, Liz, I'll soon ask you to tell us more about Comma Comma, but first, tell us about yourself, your professional background, and how you came to be a copywriter.
Sure. So I started out as a journalist back in the early noughties. I was working on a newspaper for a couple of years, and then I went freelance. But it was when I was at the newspaper that I was first introduced to copywriting, just because one of our features editors went off sick and I took over her work. And that was kind of writing advertorial type copy. So I'd go out and interview businesses and write, well, I didn't even know it was called copy then, but it was more salesy than journalism. And that was my kind of first taste of copywriting. And then when I went freelance, I was actually working with my husband in his business. He was doing photography, and people just kept saying, oh, you know, do you know anyone that can write the copy to go with these pictures that you're shooting for us? And so I ended up writing websites and brochures. And that was my first kind of, oh, foray into copy and thinking, oh, maybe I'll do this rather than journalism. And that was back in the days when you were kind of finding your own feet. You couldn't Google like how to write a website. That sort of thing didn't really exist. So I had to learn from direct response copywriters and came at it from that angle by reading all the books and going on actual real life courses, because we didn't have all the online courses that you have today.
What are these book things you're talking about?
I know, right? Actual books on paper, not even on a Kindle.
Oh, wow. And what was so, that? You said a direct response? What
yeah,
is that?
Yeah, so direct response copy is how a lot of stuff was sold in the olden days by letter. So you would write to people. And so you always knew exactly what results you got, because you'd send like 2,000 letters and you'd know how much you sold. So you could always work out what the response rate was from that campaign.
Okay, this is like the spiritual ancestor of copywriting today,
yeah,
especially
basically.
Writing emails and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I guess that was a strange time to be a journalist in the noughties, or the noughts. I assume that's when journalism started to really suffer from the move online.
Absolutely, yeah. It was really dying, and there were always lots of cuts and redundancies and stuff, and that was another thing that pushed me towards doing something else, if I'm honest.
Do you think it's a path a lot of journalists ended up taking, moving more into copy or something
similar?
Yeah,
I definitely meet a lot of journalists, former journalists in the copywriting world, for sure. There's lots of crossover. You know, the grounding I got in working in a newsroom was amazing, because everything had to be tight and concise, and it had to be delivered quickly and without using kind of long words that people don't understand the meaning. So, and that's, you know, very similar to copy. Often you're writing quite quickly and... yeah, there's lots of other things you need to learn as a copywriter, but it does have overlap for sure.
And tell us about Comma Comma. Your website tells me you offer, I'm going to quote here, conversion-focused email strategy and copywriting. Give us a brief history of Comma Comma and how you came to pick that particular niche.
Sure. So in the beginning, I was very general. I kind of did any work that was thrown at me, which I think is how a lot of people start out. And then I think as things became more digital focused, I dropped anything that wasn't online. I stopped doing brochures. I stopped doing print copy, because I could just see where the market was going. And so for a while, I did websites and email, always really focused on getting results for people. So there's quite a broad spectrum of copywriters, and some people are more at the content end, where it's maybe harder to track the results that you're getting. I'm very much at the conversion end where every sales sequence I write, see the word sales is in there, that's a clue. Every sequence I write, there's a goal, but we want to convert someone to do something, which is why it's called conversion focused copy. So we want them to take the next step, whatever that is, whether it's start your trial or go from trial to paid or, you know, upgrade or reactivate as a user, that kind of thing. So there's always a result, a goal that we want to drive to in the email sequence. Could just be selling something if I'm writing for e-commerce, for example, but there's always a goal. So you're focusing on how you get that conversion. And then the strategy side of it is just that often you'll come in and people really don't know where to start. They might have several email sequences that aren't performing and they don't know which one is going to move the needle the most, which one to start with. And I can come in and review all of their sequences and say, right, actually, this is the one we need to focus on to get you good results. And then we can move on to the others.
Okay. Let's talk about what an email sequence in concrete terms might be, just to make sure our listeners understand. My understanding is it's, for example, I sign up for a SaaS product and over the next couple of weeks or few weeks, I now get a series of emails telling me more and more about the product. Is that what you mean by email sequence?
Yeah, exactly that. And there is a strategy behind it. So, I mean, what I see quite a lot with people that have maybe done their emails in-house with someone who's not a specialist is that there's no kind of overarching journey in the emails. They're just these kind of individual emails that are being sent out and they're not taking the reader on a journey. And I think partly that's because people understand that maybe not every email is going to get read by the same person. So that's why that happens. But you have to write your sequence with the idea that one person is going to read every single email. And where are you taking them on that journey? What do you want them to think and feel about your product? And how do you want them to act? And really build that into the sequence. And that's where the strategy side of it comes in. So it's about having a real journey they can go on in the sequence.
So is it also got to work in two ways, for the person who does read each one and also for the person who just deletes most of them but reads that one because they're so busy?
Yeah, absolutely. They do have to stand alone as well.
Okay.
But yeah, you really want to take them on a journey of understanding why they should use your product, really.
Okay. And what's a typical client for you?
So I work in three different niches. So software and tech, which can be SaaS or it can be kind of your huge B2B software products. I also work with e-commerce and then I work with service-led businesses as well, which is often people who've got a course that they want to sell. Lots of people think it's ideal to specialize in one niche, but I actually enjoy being able to bring over what I learn from each niche. I think it gives you an edge in that you're saying, oh, well, this worked over here with this e-commerce client. Could I try something similar with this SaaS client so that there's lots of overlap?
Okay. There's also some variety for you. So you're not dealing with boring B2B enterprise all the time, for example. And so what's a typical client engagement? Is it like something that lasts for a week or a month? And you'll generally just produce 5 or 10 emails and then you're done? Or is it something more comprehensive?
Yeah, so a typical engagement would probably be 4 to 6 weeks writing an email sequence for a client. So my process would be to come in and do some research up front. So that would be interviewing customers. If it's B2B, it could be interviewing sales guys. I'll give you an example, actually, because it makes it easier. So this was for an outreach sequence that I did last week. This was a bit of a rush job, actually, but it's a compact version of my process. So we didn't have time to interview customers on this one. We had time for a tiny bit of competitor research, which I like to do because you need to see where you're positioned in the market and see what everyone else is doing. So that's the best way to figure out how to differentiate yourself and stand out. So I interviewed a sales guy over in the States and a sales guy here. And I asked questions like, you know, when you're on a sales call with someone, which features from the product make their eyes light up? You know, what do they get excited about? You know, what they're like, oh, wow, that's going to save us so much time, or that the team are going to love that. You know, what gets them really interested in the product? And we want to try and get those into the emails, those, because that's what will get people to get back engaged with the product if they've maybe dropped off the trial, or, you know, in this case, it's B2B. So it's going to keep them moving along on what's quite a long sales cycle. It's going to keep them interested. So I do all that. And then I base the emails on those kinds of things. I mean, there's loads of questions I ask, but I just want to find out what the most important thing to the customers are, really. And ideally I interview customers because then you get those features in the customer's language. called Voice of Customer Data. And it just means you're speaking their language, especially with really highly technical products. You don't want to be talking the way you might talk internally. You want to be speaking in the way that customers speak, because that will connect a lot better.
That makes a lot of sense. It really does. From my own experience, I've needed help to turn the words about our products into something that humans understand and not techies.
Yeah. So after the research stage, obviously, I'll write the copy. And then with this one, we're expecting to see some results within about a month. So I'll have another call with them in about a month just to optimize what they've already done. So we'll see, you know, which emails are getting opened the most, which ones maybe need the subject line changing because they're not getting opened.
Okay.
That kind of thing, which ones are getting clicks and which ones aren't. And just tweak everything so that it's, you know, getting even better results for them. So that's like a condensed version of my process. But normally I'd do that over kind of 4 to 6 weeks, just because you need time to arrange the customer interviews at the start and all of that. Mm-hmm. After the research stage, normally I would put together a messaging report so they can see everything that I've found while I've been doing the research. And I can get buy-in on the strategy that I'm going to use and the approach I'm going to take with the emails. And then I'll go away and write one email, feed it back to them so that I can just check we're on the right track. And then I'll write the rest of the sequence and get on a call and explain the thinking behind what I've done in the emails, you know, what persuasion techniques I've used, why we've done what we've done, so that everyone is clear that there's a reason behind everything I've put in the emails.
Okay. Sounds brilliant. I'm going to give everybody an example of some writing from your website. I know you're way too humble to tell them yourself, so I'm going to do it. This is from your about page. I really liked this. And I'm quoting, this is my list voice. Getting great results from my clients is like the adrenaline rush of hitting a personal best in a 10K or half marathon. That feeling when you're hitting every single mile split and you just know you're going to break all your previous records. Let's make that happen with your next email sequence. Liz, that's brilliant. Oh, I don't run. You. I don't run, but I can still even feel it, to feel the real idea that I'm achieving something like as of us running. So how long did it take you to put that together?
My website, that was a real labor of love over several months, to be honest, because I was fitting it in around client projects. Yes, I'm really pleased with it actually, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah, that's the thing is if something's really well written and tight, you look at it and think, how did it take so long? But it does take a long time to get those words just perfect.
Yeah, short copy takes longer than long copy, definitely.
So moving on, for the rest of this episode, we're going to put your talents, Liz, to a real-world scenario. We're going to take apart Sabre Feedback's current email sequence for new signups, and then we're going to talk about the process you would follow to craft a series of emails for it. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, can't wait.
Okay, some background info. Sabre Feedback is a small SaaS I acquired 8 months ago. Monthly revenue is about $4,000 per month, and we have about 50 customers. At the moment, the emails we send are, in my opinion, not as good as they should be. They were written some years ago and not by a copywriting expert, and they haven't been touched since. So, Liz, when a customer comes to you with this problem, what's the first step?
So we would review what they're already doing. So we'd look at the existing emails and we'd look at what results they're getting from those emails. And that does two things. It means I can see where you're at, but it also gives us a benchmark so that we can see what improvements we've made when we've changed the emails. So that would be my first step.
Okay. Should we do that now then?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have four or five. Immediately a confirmation email gets sent. I'm including this one because it has our branding and it does have some messaging. 5 days later, a trial warning email is sent. We have a 10-day trial, so that five-day email basically says you've got 5 days left. Then after 7 days, if the account has not been actively used yet, we send an offer of help. Then after 8 days, we send a trial expiring reminder again. And then after 10 days, the trial's over and we say, your trial's ended, you know, thanks for trying us. I think you've seen those emails, right?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, so what's your feedback on them?
Okay, so let's start with the overall sequence and then I'll dig into the individual emails. So first of all, there's some good stuff in there, but you don't get in there quick enough. So it's a 10-day trial. When people sign up to a trial, they're usually quite enthusiastic at the very start. And then, you know, they get distracted by other stuff, their interest might wane a bit. So you're not sending that reminder email until 5 days into a 10-day trial. That's way too late. That would be my first observation. You want to get them while they've just signed up, they're quite enthusiastic, and there's a chance of bringing them back into the app. Whereas 5 days down the line, they might even have forgotten they signed up for it, to be honest. Uh-huh. You know, we're all really busy, and I think, especially at the moment, very distracted by what's going on. So yeah, I'd bring that forward for a start.
Like to the same day or 2 days? Or
day one, they get their confirmation, they confirm their email, and then they should get an email straight away with something for them to do, or, you know, some kind of selling of the product to remind them to get why they want to get back into it and actually set it up. And then, you know, so, I mean, the same feedback for the whole sequence, really. It's all just a bit late in the day. The reminders are coming, you know, after 7 days, after 8 days. I like that you've got that that email just to tell the people listening. So there's five emails. Most of them are on your branded template. And then you've got this one that comes and it's plain text. That's brilliant, because plain text emails do tend to get read more. They tend to get acted on more than designed emails because they feel like they're from a real person. So that's brilliant. And it says that it's, you know, do they need help to get set up? Because if they've reached that point, is that, that's the one after 7 days, am I right?
That's right.
Yeah. So probably you need that a bit earlier, but that's really good. The only thing I'd say is, so I think you say to them, let me just bring the email up. I've got it. So you say, we just got an alert that you've not yet submitted any feedback through your Sabre feedback account. So we're reaching out to see if you're having any trouble getting Sabre feedback set up on your website. If so, we'd love to help. Just reply to this email to let us know. So what I'd want to see is just reply to this email, but then what's going to happen if they reply to this email? Because you don't say that, and that would leave me with some uncertainty. Am I going to get into a conversation via email? Is someone going to get on a call with me? I mean, I don't know how hard it is to set up your product. I'm guessing it's pretty simple, but if they need help, they might want to know how that help's going to be delivered. So I would add that in.
Okay.
You've got a really solid subject line. Do you need help setting up Sabre feedback? That's all you need. It's a does what it says on the tin subject line, right? You know, and if they do need help, they're going to click on that. The other thing I would say is, I know it's software, but regards is not that friendly. I would want to make it a little bit friendlier. And then I would, can it be from a real person? So you say it's from the Sabre feedback team. Uh-huh. I don't see a person on the end of that. I want to see a name.
Okay.
You know, and I don't know, it could be you, it could be someone in customer experience. You know, it just needs a name, really, just to give it that personal touch. And then the same, I don't know who would be in the from name because you forwarded this to me, but the from name needs to be a person. So it could be a person at Sabre or at Sabre feedback.
Okay, what is the from at the moment? I can't really. Well, you
I
said
don't know because you forwarded it to me,
yeah,
so I don't know.
That's a good question. I'll have to find that one out. Okay, so it should be from a real person.
Yeah, so it could be from Steve at Sabre Feedback or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what if I have that, but then when it comes to me, I just forward it to someone else? Is that kind of bad form? Like, they really should be engaging in a conversation with the person it claims to be from?
Yeah, ideally it would be the person that it's from, yeah. You know, unless they are going to have a conversation on Zoom or something. I don't know how you would set up that interaction. But yeah, ideally you want it to feel real and personal.
Okay, it's good to hear that one of our emails actually is pretty good. And you said about the branding that the rest of our emails have our logo and you know, colours and whatever, and this one doesn't. Should we convert all the emails to be plain text?
That would be my recommendation, yeah, if I was working with you. You know, there's mixed schools of thought on it. It really depends on the industry you're in as to what you do. Like, for example, someone like Canva, it makes sense for them to have a heavily designed email, right? Because they're in the design space, but you're not in that space. So there's no real reason for you to have a heavily designed email. And I think people open it and they go, oh, you know, it's not an email from a person. It's just a sales email or, you know. It doesn't get as much engagement. I mean, that's proven. So yeah, I would recommend that. You can still have your logo at the bottom if you want to, but yeah, just something that looks like it's from a human.
Okay. Hey, would this go for a newsletter? I know newsletters are not your thing, but an email newsletter, or is it should also be plain text or design for a B2B SaaS?
Yeah, it's really tricky. So you have to do what your team is comfortable with. So you know, when I work with the bigger players like Symantec and people like that, I'm not going to say to them, you can't have a designed email, because they're just going to ignore me. There's no point. That's not what they want. It's ingrained in the culture that they want to get their branding out there. But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of the newsletters I read and love. Some of them are designed, but there's a lot of white space. Uh-huh. It's the white space that makes people feel comfortable. I think if you've got, you know, it's good to have color elements. There's one particular newsletter that I read a lot, which is from Anne Handley, who is in content marketing. She's really well known. And there's lots of emojis and there's pictures and there might be, I don't know that she has GIFs, but definitely memes sometimes. So it breaks it up because, you know, you don't want loads and loads of text and nothing breaking it up. But it's still on a nice white background and it still feels like a very personal email. So that's what you're looking to achieve, I think, with a newsletter.
Okay. And back to the onboarding email, should I be using emoji? Or definitely not? 100% not, or maybe?
You know, that might be a question for a branding person. I don't know that it suits the brand. I mean, how much work have you done on branding? I'm guessing not tons.
After I took over the product, we did overhaul the website. We contacted as many customers as we could to understand who they were and why they use us. So,
yeah.
And we used that to redo our website, including the design.
Yeah, I think the space you're in, I probably wouldn't jump to using loads of emojis. Is something you could test. Somewhere that emojis can work quite well actually is in subject lines in emails, just to, because they attract attention in the inbox. If someone's inbox doesn't already have a lot of emojis in, there's always that proviso of you need to know what kind of emails your customers have already got in there. I think that's probably something you'd want to test. But when I look at your website, it doesn't seem like a website that's going to suit lots of emojis. Uh-huh. You know, it doesn't have that feel.
Yep.
So I probably wouldn't jump to using emojis, but they can work really well. They can be really effective.
Okay. You said about testing. The problem we have here is that we have so few people signing up each month. A good month is 20 trial signups. And it's hard to do any testing with that. So what do you do? Have you been in a situation before where you've had to make decisions and you just can't get enough data for testing? And if so, how do you make the decisions then?
Yeah, do you know what? This is where what I do is a combination of science and intuition. So my ideal is to have loads of data to work with and make a decision based on that. But because I've been doing this since, you know, I think 2008, I set up my company. So it's a long time I've been in this world. I can use intuition based on what I've seen before. And it's intuitively, I would, you know, that's where I'm saying with emojis, intuitively, I'm saying you don't seem like a brand that should be using emojis. I can't necessarily give you any data as to why that is. It just doesn't seem like it would suit your brand. And yeah, you can't test that if you've only got 20 signups. Customer feedback is the best way to go. Like, it sounds like you've already been doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with, you know, I think if you went out to some customers and had some conversations, and if you can find someone external to have those conversations, that would be ideal. Because what I find is people will tell me the most amazing things, even about, you know, solopreneur type businesses where it's just one person. Because I say at the start of every conversation with a customer, you know, I don't tell the client everything that you tell me. You can feel free to say whatever you want. And if there's something you say, but you don't want me to report back to the client on that, I won't, but it'll just inform the work that I'm doing. And I never give names of who said what to the clients.
Okay.
So people feel really comfortable talking to me and telling me all kinds of negative stuff as well as positive stuff about a product. I'm just telling you that because I think if you can get someone outside of Sober Feedback to do that work for you, that would be really beneficial. Because what you'll also get out of that is things like, you know, objections people have. If you're asking them, say, well, was there anything that made you hesitate before you signed up for this product? If you can get that information and then get that into your trial to paid emails of like, oh, you know, such and such, you know, we had a customer who thought this and they overcame that by doing this. You know, it just means they can then read the email and think, oh, yeah, I had that concern. But they've addressed it, you know.
That's brilliant. I really like that. Wow.
Yeah.
You might be thinking right now about this problem. I'm here to tell you that we don't, this is the solution. Like kind of that framework, better written, of course.
Yeah. The other thing you can do to make it more personalized, and this, you know, this might not be appropriate at this stage because if you're only getting 20 signups, I probably isn't, but just something to think about in the future is segmenting your list. So, you know, maybe in that second email, you say, just so we can give you the best help while you're in our trial, you know, who are you? And give them three links they can click. You know, are you this type of company? Are you this type of company? And then you can send them really individualized messages You know, so if it's someone who's got a course, for example, that seems like a pretty good niche to start with. You know, you could just literally divvy it up into people that have a course and people that just have a standard business. And then you can send course appropriate messaging to them.
Oh, wow. I really like that. That actually kind of solves a problem for messaging. We have a lot of our customers have online courses, either for professionals or for universities, and they use us to let people report errors, typos, broken links, or outdated information. But a lot of people, some of our customers are not like that, and that would be irrelevant messaging. Mm. So I really like that idea of letting people tell you who they are in a very easy way. So it does mean we make more emails, right? We have to
at some point divide. Two sequences. Yeah, that's the only downside. But it's more likely that you'll connect with people if you do that.
And you would ask that in the sign-up process? Or
it would be one of the first emails. Yeah, I mean, you could do it in the sign-up process. That would definitely save time in terms of not needing quite so many emails. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Hey, another question I wanted to ask you about is that trick I heard about where you put a PS at the bottom of the email and that tends to be one of the highest read things. Is that still appropriate? Is that relevant to do in this type of email sequence?
It can be. It definitely still works. There's definitely people that scan an email and then just read the PS. I don't know that you need it in this kind of sequence. You really want them to be very focused in on that one message. So this is the other thing that's really important in the email sequence is that each email is only trying to do one thing.
Okay.
So like you've got your confirmation email. The only thing you want them to do in that is to confirm their email address. And then your next email will have one goal. And then your next email will have one goal. So there's only one thing you want them to do in that email. So you could have a PS that, you know, tries to get them again to do the one thing you wanted them to do. But I don't know that you need it in this sort of sequence. It's probably more appropriate in... What kind of sequence would you use that? I mean, when I work with course creators and those kinds of people, they'll often be a PS in a sales sequence.
Okay, and they'll be longer form emails, I guess.
Yeah, longer form emails.
So our onboarding emails, long or short?
Short is good.
Like a paragraph or two sentences short or?
Well, it's kind of the wrong question. So let's talk through a bit more about how we would create the sequence. So after we've done the research phase and spoken to some customers, we would know more about what messages we want to get across. And so we would pick out those key messages and we would want to deliver one in each email. And we're thinking about each email as a sales email. So we are selling your product. I know they've already signed up to the trial, but they're not totally bought in because they haven't bought the product yet. So we're selling the product to them. We're not just because what your emails do currently is really just remind them the trial's coming to an end. And that's not enough. We need to really sell the product to them. So each email will have one message, one thing we want them to do. And we're trying to get them to that aha moment where they think, oh, I get why I need this. This is brilliant. You know, that's where we're trying to get them to. And each email needs to drive towards that. So tell me about something that a customer loves about your product.
You're asking me right now to tell you?
Yeah.
That it will take a screenshot where the person giving the feedback can take a screenshot highlighting a specific element on the page where the error or problem is.
Okay, so you might create a really nice little GIF of someone doing that and have that at the top of your email. So just like a moving GIF of like, here's someone taking a screenshot. And so because they might not be aware of that feature.
Okay.
And then you tell them why that's so great. So why is that so great? Why is that such a selling point for them, do you think?
Because that makes it very easy for them to find the problem and fix it without having to do follow-up emails and with those sort of issue reports you get where someone says, there's a problem and I forget which page, but I think it was this one. They get the company with our customer gets very precise information that makes it really easy for them to keep their quality as good as possible.
Yeah, so that's definitely one of your emails.
Okay.
So what you want to be saying is, here's this great thing that it does, and this is why it's so great, and this is what it will do for you, you know, so that you can achieve X. So that's definitely one of your emails in the sequence, and you probably want that fairly early on.
Okay, like the first one?
Yeah, I mean, we'd need to know what all the other messaging is going to be in each email. But yeah, I mean, I can give you examples from sequences I've worked on. I mean, I did one for a company called GitPrime, which was a really highly technical product. It's now been bought by Pluralsight. And it essentially helps software development teams to really get insight into where people are getting stuck and, you know, the process. So we had one email and this was from voice of customer data, where somebody said something like, code is dying on the vine, because essentially people were creating these huge, huge pull requests and the code wasn't getting committed. And so you'd get to the end of a sprint and they were really behind because everyone would see these huge pull requests and not want to delve into them. And so we had a whole email about that. This was in a drive to demo sequence. So they'd already signed up to the demo, but we wanted them to actually turn up to the demo. So that's what that sequence was. And, you know, that sequence, I think, doubled the number of people turning up to demos. So it was quite powerful. But every single email was taken from the interviews with customers of what was important to them and using their language so that it really connected. And, you know, those were quite long emails. So to answer your original question about length, you use the number of words you need to get the message across and you don't worry so much about length.
Okay. The number of words we need and not a word more.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's where your journalism background and typewriting comes in.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What else would you recommend that we do with our email sequence?
So you might want to consider having more emails in there. I wouldn't position really any of them as a reminder until the very end about the trial ending, because they know it's a 10-day trial. They haven't forgotten it's a 10-day trial. I mean, what's the logic behind it being 10 days? Is that based on any data or is it just what you picked?
It's what I inherited when I bought the product. Right. And I'm trying to change as few things like that yet until I have a good reason for changing them. Mm-hmm. I probably would have had a longer trial if I was creating the product, but I just assumed the previous owner knew what he was doing.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, I mean, 10 days seems fine to me, but I don't know how difficult the product is to use. I mean, probably something to think about as well is some triggered emails. So is, you know, the one you send, the one that actually says, do you need help? Is that triggered by them definitely not having been in there?
Yeah, it's triggered if they haven't yet received any feedback. So how the product works is you create an account, you create a feedback form, then you have to copy a snippet of JavaScript onto your website. And at that point, people using the website can give feedback. And we find most people, almost like I say, 80% of signups actually create that first feedback form. And then we can't tell if they've copied the snippet of JavaScript to the site or not. We have no access into that information. So all we can do is tell whether they've started receiving feedback, like their own test. Almost everybody will do a test of it themselves the first time. And if that hasn't happened, then they get this email after 7 days.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I think 7 days is probably a little bit too late. Would they normally be just testing it in terms of get someone in their team to give some feedback and see if it works rather than rolling it out to anyone
themselves? Yeah. And, you know, I would imagine they do this on the spot. Like they sign up for an account, do this stuff while they're still in the mood and do a test email. So probably even after 1 or 2 days, we could be sending this email.
Yeah. So something you might want to do actually is talk to people who've done the free trial and not signed up and find out, you know, what stopped them, what held them back, why didn't they send any feedback? Was it just that they ran out of time? They were too busy? Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of things you can test. So it could be if they were too busy or they just got distracted, you might want to consider sending them a little trial extension at the end. Like if you can see that there's been some activity, but they haven't quite got off the ground with it, you could suggest, oh, you know, have 3 more days on us, you know, last chance saloon kind of thing, just to try it out. Or maybe it's 2 days, you know, if it's a very quick amount of activity they need to do, you know, have 2 more days.
Just to give them a time constraint so they actually feel the urgency.
Yeah, exactly that, the urgency. That's one thing you could try. If I was redoing this sequence, I think, let's imagine that we've spoken to customers and we've got 5 different things that they're really excited about to do with your product. And we send out an email every day from day 1 to day 5 with those things. And then we start talking about, you know, the trial's ending soon, but still treating each email as a sales email as to why they should get on and send some feedback to test it out. You know, if you've got a case study you can link to, that's always helpful, of a client that's similar to them. So if you have segmented, you might have one course one and one company one that you link to. Because actually segmenting doesn't have to be as complicated as people make out. It can just be as simple as on those 2 emails, we send them a different case study. You know, it doesn't have to be all that complicated. Yeah. And then, remind us at the very end. And, you know, you could test out I appreciate you don't have a lot of people to test it on, but you could test out just that that reminder where you say, oh, have two more days on us. Mm-hmm. That would be how I'd look at it. But and then it's also about optimizing. So the way I work, you know, I have a hypothesis of what's going to work and we create a sequence based on that. But then that's not done. That's, mm-hmm. you know, you're never finished. you want to look at it again in maybe 4 weeks' time and say, oh, like what's improved, what's working, what's not working, which emails aren't getting opened? Do we need to change any of the subject lines? Because obviously eye-catching subject lines is half the battle. You just need to get the emails opened as a starting point. So do you know your open rates off the top of your head?
No, we're not measuring them. No. At the moment, the emails are just sent directly from our software. We're not going through any tools such as MailChimp or anything that gives you that data. A quick question. We're actually normally would be running out of time. Are you in a rush? Can you talk for a few minutes more?
I'm not in a rush, no.
Good. I'm going to break my normal 30-minute or so rule because this is a really good conversation. So I wanted to ask about tools. What would you normally use or recommend as a way to handle the sending and the segmenting and the measuring of the results?
Yeah, sure. So for a company like yours, you should look at UserList, which is, I think, relatively new. I've heard really good things about it. You know, it's aimed at people without the huge budget that you might need for something like Intercom. And you can use in-app messaging as well as kind of triggered emails and all of that side of things. So it's quite a useful way to interact with signups.
Okay. Is that Jane Portman's company?
Yeah.
Okay. That's funny because I was interviewed on her podcast just recently and I think it might even be getting published today or next week. So,
cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear you recommend that. I'll definitely take a look at it.
Yeah, it's a solid choice.
Okay. Okay. Have you used it?
I haven't actually. No, I'm just recommending it on hearsay. You know, I tend to work with quite a lot of bigger companies with huge budgets. So they tend to have stuff at the top end of the market a lot of the time. But yeah, you definitely want to be looking at a product that is geared for SaaS rather than kind of the MailChimps of the world. That would be my opinion.
Oh, awesome. Okay. I've made a note of that. And for, as I said, like we have very little data and it's going to be hard to get any meaningful sense out of it in the first place. But I like the idea of setting this up now so that as our strategy for getting more traffic actually works, we have that in place already and we can really be seeing the historical effects of our content.
Oh yeah, definitely. Start as you mean to go on. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you'd like to suggest?
Yeah, I think beyond what I've already said, you know, figuring out what that aha moment is, you know, to give an example from kind of software we all know and maybe love or hate, Facebook, you know, I think their original aha moment was something like, we need to drive someone to have 7 friends within 10 days. And that was kind of a tipping point that meant someone would definitely kind of start interacting more with the platform rather than just kind of let it fade away. That mm-hmm. was in the early days. I mean, I guess they probably have different goals now. But yeah, you need to figure out what is that aha moment, that thing that they do where then they're like, oh, wow, yeah, I see why we need this. So it's figuring that out and driving the sequence towards that aha moment. It probably is, I would imagine, pushing them to send some feedback.
So just to summarize, what we have here is first, we need to talk to people. That's the mistake a lot of developers make. We just don't like talking to people, but we have to do that. And second, use that information to do a new sequence of 5 emails, sending 1 per day for the first 5 days. Would we skip weekends? Is that important or no?
No, I wouldn't.
Okay.
No. I mean, do you check your email at the weekend?
I check my email all the time.
There we go.
Okay. So, and then in those, each email would be covering just one thing, sell one particular part of our product. And maybe if we know that there's typical concerns people have, maybe one of them, those emails would be addressing that particular concern.
Yeah.
Okay. And then after 5 days, we would then start reminding people the trial's coming to an end, or we would just wait until the very last day about reminding them?
Yeah, no, you start reminding them. So maybe you have an email on day 7, just reminding them, hey, you've got a couple more days to do this. Here's what you could do next. And maybe you want to tell them how long it takes. Because I know for myself, often I'll look at stuff and I'm doing a ClickUp trial at the moment. It's like a project management tool. And I really want to get in there, but it looks like it'll take me a long time to get it set up. And I just can't quite make the time to do it. But maybe if someone said like, hey, here's someone in your industry who set up ClickUp and this is how they did it, and it took exactly 73 minutes, you know, then I'd be like, oh, okay, I can book 73 minutes out in my diary and get this done, you know? So something like that, where you say like, this is what you need to do. This is how long it takes. Just make it easy for them.
Okay. And then when the trial does expire, assuming they haven't become a paying customer, then we would send them one last email saying, all good things must come to an end, or maybe something less cheesy than
maybe
that.
Maybe less cliche than that, yeah.
but your trial's over. If you'd like another couple of days, or somehow offer them two more days or three more days on the trial so they can just get that chance, one last chance to actually try us out.
Yeah, I mean, you might even want to do something like give them two options of like, you know, give us feedback on why, you know, you haven't converted. Obviously, you wouldn't word it like that. And the other option is, or grab two more days so you can really try this out, you know, and then you're going to get a sense of, well, did they just, they did actually see what it was like and they don't want it, or they just didn't have time. Yeah.
This is some real concrete information. I think we should wrap it up. So thanks again, Liz. This has been really awesome. I just, even more than I expected.
It's good to hear, Steve. Thanks for having me.
And if anyone wants to get in touch, what's the best way?
The best way is probably email, which is liz@comma.co.uk, or come find me on LinkedIn. I'm quite active on LinkedIn, Liz Painter.
Okay. Actually, this is where we had our contact, wasn't it?
Yes.
We met originally at the Business of Software conference.
We met at LinkedIn. Business Software, that's right, yeah.
And then LinkedIn maintained the communication. Okay, we will have all that information in the show notes, of course. That's it.
Brilliant.
Bye, Liz.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. That concludes this episode of Bootstrapped. You can discuss this episode and other bootstrapping topics on our forums at discuss.bootstrapped.fm.